Good morning. At least, it is if you're inside. Out there, it's about minus 2 Celsius, or 28 Fahrenheit, which is a break because this weekend, the low is predicted to be around minus 20, which, yes, will make it below zero even for our American friends. And it's remarkable how quickly such conditions become deadly if you're not protected. Whereas in here, it's about 22 Celsius, which I can adjust up or down at will, and I'm sitting here in shirt sleeves looking at some remarkable information about Canada's oil and gas industry. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson. I assume that you all know that Canada is a major oil and gas producer, and that it has been for years. Over 160 of them, in fact. But a great many people also think that these fossil fuels are yucky and outdated. They're a dirty relic of a bygone era full of low-skilled workers, they're fading fast, a dinosaur doomed to extinction, and the sooner the better. Well, not so fast. For one thing, we're the fourth largest producer of crude oil and the fifth largest producer of natural gas in the entire world, despite the best efforts of our governments and activists over the past decade and more. And this industry, broadly conceived, also contributes about 3% of our GDP. As a matter of fact, oil and gas extraction is the largest good-producing industry in Canada. It's bigger than engineering and other construction activities, which is how Statistics Canada lumps these things, and it's bigger than residential construction. So, even if you feel that we must stop using petroleum-based fuels to save the planet, don't imagine that it's this small, embarrassing, dark corner of our economy that we'd barely miss if it were gone. For one thing, the oil and gas sector also employs 500,000 people directly, and around 1 million people if you count various suppliers to the industry, and it pays better than the average. A lot better. Compensation in oil and gas direct jobs is about twice what it is in other goods-producing industries. And that's no surprise once you discover that it's also amazingly productive. Labor productivity, for all industries, it was $63.20 per hour in 2024, but for oil and gas extraction, $428.30, and for non-conventional oil extraction, $457.10. Whereas you might easily have been given the impression that it's a bunch of guys with grade 9 educations in grimy hard hats, chewing tobacco while watching sludge drip out of rusty pipes. For instance, here's a 2018 tweet from this classic Canadian Laurentian pundit Paul Wells, and he's quoting a mercifully long-forgotten trendy report on a global innovation economy from the Council of Canadian Academics. The Canadian economy is dominated by industries in which R&D is not a core component of business strategy. Oil and gas, construction, real estate, and finance industries, for example, rely more extensively on natural resources, capital, and talent than R&D, end quote. Now, of course, there's something to be said for talent, and even for capital, at least among some people. But if you believe the thing about our energy industry being hewers of wood and drawers of water, let alone dirty hewers and drawers, you have been deceived. Before we get too far into that point, as we definitely intend to, it's important here to grasp the big picture with respect to the big picture. You can comb through GDP statistics till your eyes ache if you like that kind of thing, including the decimal places. But impressive as they are, they actually dramatically understate the situation. I mean, look at this hotel room that I'm sitting in here in Calgary. It has all the modern conveniences, including in this case, an excellent restaurant. And it has all the ancient necessities. No, really, food and shelter. These things were necessities for humanity long before clothing mattered very much, because we are fundamentally a tropical species, and like corals, we still huddle near the equator for warmth on today's chilly planet. Which is why it's so desirable that it's warm and cozy in here, though the cold wind laments wildly and the winter rages right outside that window. It's extraordinary how quickly hypothermia sets in, and it's also extraordinary that we don't know about it here in the advanced world because we live such a fortunate lifestyle and so often fail to appreciate it. Including, of course, that this building is solidly built. There aren't any drafts in here, there are no holes in the wall, and there's no prospect of sudden collapse. And maybe now you laugh. No, duh, it won't collapse. But taking that for granted is a luxury. It is only safe, certain that this building will not collapse, unlike the disasters that happen in much of the world even today, because of modern engineering. And that modern engineering relies on the power of machinery that, yeah, you guessed it, isn't running on solar panels and it's not running on burning wood. So we're fortunate to be able to take these things for granted, and we should be grateful, not entitled, whiny, and ignorant. As we should also be grateful, you'll note, for plugs that work, gleaming appliances, including temperature control at my fingertips, and even, yes, lights that go on. I know, we're so used to it, we barely see it, and we complain if the walls are the wrong shade of beige or the kettle on switch is poorly placed. But even in countries like Azerbaijan, with plenty of oil, you can't take that kind of stuff for granted. And in Senegal, you're lucky if there even is a plug, and people pay the price. But we don't, not even when we travel. For instance, when I went to Baku in Azerbaijan for COP29, some of the hotel plugs were dead, and you couldn't drink the water coming out of that wobbly tap. But of course, they gave us privileged Westerners bottled water in plastic bottles, delivered by a truck burning gas or diesel, having been manufactured who knows where. They didn't provide those bottles to the people of Baku, you understand, just Homo conferensis dropping by to posture and blithely and unconsciously using conveniences that he didn't understand, right down to the steam coming out of the soy latte machine, which I promise you was not generated by a windmill. Oh, and here I have to mention that I actually flew with bottles of water to Calgary because of the busted water mains, though by the time I arrived they were at least temporarily fixed. It was hard for me to believe, even while I was packing them, that it was actually an efficient use of fuel of any sort. But it's what happens when you focus on DEI and not core duties. It's funny that the other day someone asked me what I do, and I explained about the climate discussion nexus, and they said, "Oh, so you're in favor of oil," as though I'd blithely revealed a shameful secret that most people at least have the wit to conceal if they don't have the character to avoid. But I thought it was an odd question, because yes, of course I'm in favor of what oil gives us, everything from warmth and food to fabric. I mean, look, if someone invented a superior energy source, if fusion energy suddenly became practical, I wouldn't be jumping up and down saying, no, keep burning oil instead. That's assuming that we could get the electricity transmission infrastructure in place, and adequate batteries, and all the other secondary issues. But if we did all that, in that kind of a world, yeah, I'd expect petrochemicals rapidly to become feedstock for plastics, with their energy function becoming largely a historical curiosity. But we don't live in that world, and we don't have a path to it yet, and it matters. Even if you think oil and gas are bad for the planet, which I don't for reasons I've explained at great length in various CDN posts and videos that you can find on our website, you still have to recognize that for now, we need them or our lives would collapse. At the moment, and what I want you to focus on here, what I want everyone to focus on, there is currently no substitute for oil and gas, and it's an incredibly dynamic industry that seems to get nothing but abuse. And it matters enormously because everything we take for granted, here or while gallivanting about the globe pontificating, virtually without exception, it comes from oil and gas. It certainly all comes from energy, and even Canada with its impressive hydro resources and once mighty nuclear industry that governments and activists have also worked very hard to dismantle, depends primarily on hydrocarbons for warmth, and yes, for food and for shelter. And even the stuff that comes right from the hydro dam to your socket does so with the help of things made from hydrocarbons, like the insulation on the wires, and a lot of the construction of that infrastructure depends on hydrocarbon energy. Again, look at this hotel room. Possibly it strikes you as prosaic, maybe you are blasé about hotel rooms. But nothing here, I mean literally nothing, would be here without oil and gas. Not the structural steel, not the paint, not the wiring, not the dishes, not the mirror, not the TV. Nothing. Try running a blast furnace on solar power, or a transport truck, or a hospital. As Canadian energy entrepreneur Michael Binion rightly says, it's a modern miracle. And far too many of us don't just disparage it, we dismiss it, even while complacently living a lifestyle that we'd be miserable without and that we wouldn't have without it. For instance, the cool modern clothing that lets me mock the wintry weather. It isn't just made with oil and gas, it's made from them. As some of you may recall, that back in 2021, Chris Wright, he was then head of Liberty Energy and is now the United States Secretary of Energy, Wright gave trendy North Face outdoor gear makers the knucklebone shampoo for refusing to make logo gear for an oil and gas firm. He made fun of their ignorance about the feedstocks that went into their fancy breathable fabrics and so on, and, as we put it at the time, perhaps they thought there were Gore-Tex trees in the rainforest. Then there's the activist cellular telephones. And mine. Not to mention the food in the restaurant, grown with tractors that are themselves high-tech marvels nowadays, transported in trucks, refrigerated. You know, I could go on and on, and if I did, or if I already did, it would be all about energy. Including this key point that, as the truckers like to remind us, if you have it, a truck brought it. And those trucks overwhelmingly run on petroleum. Sure, there are some EVs doing package delivery inside the cities, but the whole infrastructure depends on the big rigs, and they depend on oil and gas. So, those statistics about 3% of GDP understate the matter. They really understate it, and they understate it dramatically. If I might don my mortarboard briefly, I'm no neo-Keynesian macroeconomist, mistaking abstractions for reality and thinking of the economy as a machine full of parts just begging for some state tinkering. It's far more organic and interrelated in subtle ways. But I won't go off on a Hazlitt, Hayek, eye-pencil tangent here, except to say that to think of oil and gas as an isolated sector, whether grubby and antiquated or gleaming and futuristic, is entirely to misunderstand the situation. It's not unlike tallying up the contribution that food makes to the economy and then pronouncing that, well, without food we'd all be 24.3% poorer or 12.8% poorer or some such mathiness, when of course without food we'd all be dead. And by the same token, if oil and gas were to vanish tomorrow, we'd all be dead by Thursday. No, really, no transporting food around, no way to heat our homes, no getting anywhere except on foot. In that very important sense, energy is 100% of the economy. And without oil and gas, the residual part wouldn't be enough to keep us alive. Now, I'm not going to barge into a maternity ward here to make the point about giving birth in a hospital rather than a hut. They're kind of busy in there. So I'm just going to a supermarket. But next time you are in or near a hospital, pay attention to how much of it depends on energy. Not just the light and the heat, the construction, the manufacturing, the plastics, the electronics, the pharmaceuticals, how the doctors and nurses and other staff live, how they get to work. And you might also consider how long you'd last walking from hotel to supermarket girded only in a loincloth. Of course, there are people who are going to say, ah, but soon it will all be renewables and alternative energy. Wind and solar will take over. Which I think is rather bad economics even in the micro sense. These people don't understand how wind turbines and solar panels are made. The amount of energy consumed getting, processing, and assembling the raw materials, then transporting the machinery, constructing the bases, and then, of course, disposing of the panels and blades when they wear out, because these things, funnily enough, are not renewable in any plausible sense of that word. Now, that doesn't mean there won't be some marvelous breakthrough in these industries, from generation to storage to creation to disposal, and if there is, I'm not going to be sorry. It would be great, especially to have a more diverse source of energy. And there are certain advantages. Solar, obviously, is much better at being decentralized, if it works. But the point is, we haven't had those breakthroughs yet. Not by a country mile and more. And all of it bears repeating. Or for that matter, saying it all. Because here I want to add that to my frustration, even Canada's splendid energy industry is somewhat prone to groveling on this point. For years, they've been claiming to be leaders in not producing carbon while producing hydrocarbons, and it has made enemies of some of their friends without making friends of any of their enemies. Years ago, a friend of mine challenged the then Vice President for Communications and Public Engagement for the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers to challenge the supposed science, and he gave the most extraordinary response.
Well, I would come back to my remark that we can be right or we can be happy, but we can't be both. And the fact of the matter is the politics of climate change in this country are decided. And we can either be on the leading side of that and we can sell to what the idea to what Canadians are willing to buy, or we can argue with Canadians and go nowhere.
And as you may know, it's a stark alarmist claim that oil companies know exactly how much damage they're doing to the earth and have known about it for decades and lie about it for filthy lucre. If you doubt me, just Google, quote, Exxon New, end quote. But actually, the reverse is true, at least in CAP. where the guy that they paid to make them look good admitted in public that they knew they weren't destroying the planet, but they lied that they were in order to win friends and influence people. I can't think of a worse marketing strategy. Our product destroys the Earth, get yours today. But somehow it appeals, to them at least. Even today, those numbers that I was citing come from a CAP site whose first sidebar tab is carbon capture, utilization, and storage in Canada. And again, let me concede, if it's true that carbon is pollution, not just in the sense of choking us, but burning up the planet, then obviously we do need to stop using it and we need to stop producing it, even though we're then in a lot of trouble because of what life would be like without it, namely, like death. A lot like death. But the point is, it's not true. And I don't think they do themselves any favors by saying that it is, unless they actually believe it. In which case, honestly, they should get out of a business that they themselves consider not just doomed, but also wicked. I don't believe it. At CDN, we've spent plenty of time debunking that carbon pollution nonsense, and we will again. But for our purposes here at this point, let's just focus on this absurd notion that oil and gas is a minor and on balance negative part of our lives and our economy that should be disposed of and easily could be. Including this strange concept of it as primitive, a matter of, I don't know, donkey-powered derricks or flaring sour gas as if we lived in the Soviet Union. So to challenge that notion, we're now delighted to be in scenic Edson, Alberta, where it's currently about -6, and you'll notice that we're not about to have a ripe fig drop into our mouths as we might if we were somewhere warm like Mesopotamia. In fact, there are no crops growing around me at the moment because despite all this strange babble you hear about warmth killing crops, it's actually cold that stops plants from growing. And surely, in some corner of their minds, everybody knows it. Of course, plenty of Canadians do manage to live and work in places like this, but it's a tribute to our ingenuity and determination, not to the beneficial impact of cold on agriculture. And our energy industry is also a tribute to our ingenuity and determination. Even the so-called tar sands, as activists like to insult them, are in fact a miracle of engineering, not least because they're even further north than this and in even nastier conditions. What's more, they're also a miracle of environmental cleanup, ironically, since they're essentially a gigantic oil spill that Mother Nature did, from which Canadian workers and entrepreneurs are removing the oil and then selling it to make people's lives better, here and abroad, while freeing nature from a material that, whatever its merits, isn't great for trees or foxes or what have you. In fact, the whole industry's a miracle, and we're glad to say it's one they're willing to share with you through us. Thank you.